Okay, folks, welcome back after your reading week. It's been a productive and useful week for you. Nice to see you again. Today, we're going to do some work on Marxism. And I'm going to be speaking about it under three kind of headings. First of all, fundamental concepts, based on superstructure first, then the question of class, and finally the question of ideology. I'm going to spend quite a lot of time on ideology once I get there, I think. Secondly, I want to talk about production and materialism. And there, the name of Pierre Maguerre, it's up on the board here, M-A-C-H-E-R-E-Y, will come up. And thirdly, I'm going to speak about Marxism being against interpretation. And there, the name of Louis Althusser will come up. I'm going to start by doing something which I think is pretty unusual and which many people might find uncomfortable. Is there anybody here who would describe themselves as a Marxist? Can you stick your hand up? I have got a big problem with my hands then, if there's no Marxists here. My task today is going to be to persuade you to become one. And that's slightly unusual. We're kind of shy in literary criticism to try to persuade people to be committed to a particular kind of point of view. It's often thought that universities are full of lefty intellectuals and indoctrinating students. This morning's your opportunity to find out how that looks. I'm going to have a go at doing it, and I'm going to have a go at persuading you to become a Marxist. And that's for a very important reason, not necessarily because I might be a Marxist, although I am, but because the whole question of Marxism has to do with particular kinds of political commitment. And those of us who are engaged with Marxism realise that those kinds of political commitment should have something to do with our business as literary or cultural critics. So let me begin by quoting from Marx, actually. This is the beginning of a smashing text called The 18th Brumaire of Louis Bonaparte. I've not given this to you on the handout. It just occurred to me this morning. This text begins, the second paragraph of the text is the one that I want to draw your attention to. Marx writes here, "Men make their own history, but they do not make it just as they please. They do not make it under circumstances chosen by themselves, but under given circumstances directly encountered and inherited from the past. The tradition of all the generations of the dead weighs like a nightmare on the brain of the living. And just when they seem involved in revolutionising themselves and things, in creating something that has never before existed, it's precisely in such periods of revolutionary crisis that they anxiously conjure up the spirits of the past to their service and borrow names, battle cries and costumes from them in order to act out the new scene of world history in this time-honoured disguise in this borrowed language." Okay. That seems to me to be non-controversial, actually. That seems to me to be a simple statement of fact. Men, let's correct the sexist language, men and women make their own history, but they do not make it just as they please. Who could disagree with that? Any of you? Okay, so you're on your way. You're agreeing with the first sentence of Marx here, let's proceed. "They do not make it under circumstances chosen by themselves, but under given circumstances directly encountered and inherited from the past." If we take that seriously, it says something very fundamental about our position. It says, first up, we are historically situated, that we are, the possibilities that we have for doing certain things, for making our own history, are delimited in certain ways. And they're delimited by quite simply by our historical situatedness. And that has something to do with freedom. And I'm going to come back to that towards the end of what I have to say today. Most literary theories, as we've seen, relate literary texts to something else, to the literary history of forms, to the author, to the reader, to society, and so on. Many people think that Marxist literary theory is simply a way of relating literature to society. And that's true, but it's banal and it's weak. It's a very weak version of Marxism. After all, most criticism has always related texts to society in one way or another. Since most literary theories have been based on a kind of mimesis, that's to say, they've been based on a question of how it is that certain texts represent something else, something that's non-linguistic. Sorry for that. Okay. But Marxist criticism is much more specific than this. And in order to begin to understand what Marxist criticism fundamentally is about, I want to take you through some basic concepts. When formalist and new criticism, the kind of stuff that we've talked about before, when they try to persuade us to look at the text as in itself it really is, if you remember looking at the words on the page and so on, all that kind of stuff, Marxism begins instead from the realisation that it's simply impossible to do that. So it's an impossible falsification to look at the text as in itself it really is. That's a quotation from Matthew Arnold, looking at the text as in itself it really is. Formalism, new criticism, and all bourgeois criticisms try to persuade a reader to isolate the literary text from everything else round about it. And this, they claim, as we've seen before, is objective, scientific, and in the interest of being literary critics and not something else, they will thus try to evacuate all non-literary materials from the text and will not consider the text's relation to its determining factors. Most obviously, of course, the American New Criticism, remember, American New Criticism says, let's not bother too much about authorial intention. You and I might have thought that the authorial intention is one of the determining factors governing the shape of the text, but American criticism says, no, let's not waste our time on that, let's look at the text as in itself it really is, at the words on the page. The Marxist, however, begins from the opposite premise. The Marxist begins from the realisation that texts don't just spring out of nowhere. They are produced in particular ways, at particular times, and their shape, content, form, everything about them is specific to those conjunctures, those historical conjunctures, as we tend to call them. It would have been impossible, for instance, for Shakespeare, gifted as he was, it would be impossible for Shakespeare to have written like Samuel Beckett, quite simply because of Shakespeare's historical and cultural moment. Certain questions that Beckett worries about, questions that we've learnt to think of as nihilism, absurdism, and so on, were simply not available to Shakespeare. Nor was the language in which Beckett writes, or the rhythms in which Beckett writes. These simply were not available to Shakespeare. Likewise, it's kind of difficult for us now to write like Keats without it looking like a rather weak parody of Keats, because our historical conjuncture requires, demands, and in fact determines what we can write to a large extent. We are not, as it were, totally free to write whatever we like. We might believe that we're free, we might want to believe that we're free to do that, but there are limits and limitations on what we can do. Writers do not write in a vacuum. Writers are always located in history and in a specific historical conjuncture or position. They are quite simply situated, and their situation determines what it's possible for them to think, what it's possible for them to take for granted, as it were, without thinking about too much. The texts which these authors write, we Marxists would say, are thus determined, as a key word in Marxism, determined by the social and historical moment of their production, another key word in Marxism. They are not determined just by some kind of transcendent author who exists outside of the historical concerns that has shaped that author. Texts, therefore, if we are to proceed scientifically, if we are to proceed objectively, if we are to proceed with an interest in knowledge, texts cannot be isolated from their historical and social environment. The Marxists would suggest that the bourgeois critic who wants to isolate the text is working at what the Marxists would call at the level of a social superstructure, and I'll explain that in a second. By contrast, the Marxists want to find out what makes that superstructure possible. And the Marxists would call that the base. We have an opposition in Marxism between what Marx calls the base and the superstructure. Let me try to explain that to you. In classical Marxism, the base is the economic base. The economic relations that are predominant in a given society basically shape everything else within that society. If I were, an early generation vulgar Marxist, I would stop at that point. Let me be a vulgar Marxist for a moment to explain this a little more fully. If our basic human relations are governed by, for example, the economic structure of capitalism that dominates our society, that shapes our society, that makes our society possible, then we can begin to understand how it is that we relate to each other. In economic terms, we relate to each other in terms of an employer and a worker. The employer has a certain capital, which she or he will then use in various ways to try to, as it were, make that capital bigger. They want more capital. And one of the ways in which they will do this is by using the worker to produce more capital. The worker doesn't have very much capital. She or he is beholden to the employer to get what capital they can. Let's call it money. Okay? So I'm a worker, I don't have very much money. You're an employer, you've quite a lot of money. I need to do what you tell me to do in order to make some more money. But when I do that, when I take a batch of cotton, which is worth, let's say, £20, and produce through my labour on it a coat which is worth £200, do you give me the £880? No. You give me a fiver. And you keep the rest of the surplus value that's been produced by my labour. In other words, what we have here is an economic structure that's based upon exploitation. Quite simply, quite crudely, exploitation. Now, the vulgar Marxist, or the first generation Marxist, says that that structure shapes everything else in our society. When, for example, you fall in love, you think of it as an emotional investment that you might want to make in another person. As they say in the L'Oreal advert, are you worth it? Is it worth it? I've taken this risk before. It hasn't paid off. My erotic investment did not pay off. I came out of it feeling unhappy rather than having my happiness doubled. But I'm very aware of the fact that given that, I will not necessarily commit myself to this new relationship as wholeheartedly as I might have done had I not had that bad investment in the past. You are currently engaged in making an investment in something called education. And that is for, we are told, economic reasons. Apparently, you're going to be much better off having made this investment now. And you think, therefore, of knowledge in terms of investment. An investment of 3 years' study, think of Love's Labour's Lost. An investment of 3 years' study, divorced from the world, which will allow you to come back and rejoin the world, having been poor for 3 years, now potentially rich. As you know, it doesn't quite work out like that, but that's the structure that governs things. So the economic base, which is fundamentally one of capital, shapes everything else in our society. It also shapes cultural matters, including things like falling in love, or reading literature, or engaging in any kind of cultural activity. But as I pointed out, in capitalism, there's a fundamental conflict of interests here. My interests as a worker are very different from your interests as an employer. Clearly, in that structure of exploitation, we're trying to get different things. Now, if we all acknowledge that fact, that we're trying to get different things, then we might have a real social conflict. Because all of we workers who are feeling a wee bit exploited might actually say, stop that, to the employer. And we might actually rise up against the employer, seize control of the means and modes of production in, let's say, the factory that we're in, and distribute the wealth produced by that factory more equally than is currently happening under capitalism. Capitalism is profoundly aware of this fact, and capitalism works very hard to try to persuade people that there is no conflict, that we all share exactly the same interests, that it is in your interest as a worker, or in my interest as a worker, to, as it were, forego certain kinds of reward just now in order that we can, as it were, have more work tomorrow. So you, the employer, will try to persuade me that it's a good idea that you don't give me the £180 that I've just produced of surplus value for you. because you need it, quotes unquote, to invest, for example. You need it so that tomorrow I can carry on making quotes and getting another £5 tomorrow, while you're getting another £180. But the employer will try to forget that bit and explain to you that this, as it were, is part of our common interests. A certain relation of exploitation or class division, a division of class interests, becomes very apparent under capitalism. And what happens here is that Marx thinks these different groups in terms, quite simply, of social class. Working class or proletariat against, let's say, bourgeois class or employer, and there's a further class, of course, called the aristocracy, but let's leave them out of it for the moment. So a relation of exploitation lies at the root of capitalism. And that relation, Marxists argue, affects everything that happens at the level of what's called the superstructure. You might think of that as the non-material or the cultural aspects of our society. While the American New Criticism and formalism struggles hard, remember, to reconcile oppositions, remember all that stuff we talked about, especially with American New Criticism, that one of the things you're trying to do all the time is to identify potential oppositions, but also find a way in which the text reconciles those oppositions. While those kind of criticisms reconcile oppositions, Marxists find one dominant opposition at work in society, and that is the opposition of classes. For Marx, class struggle is the motor of history. That's a direct quotation. Class struggle is the motor of history. It's only through class struggle, one class struggling against another, that tomorrow will be different from today. In other words, that we can be in something called history. If tomorrow is exactly the same as today, then we are not in the realm of history. History requires that tomorrow be different from today, as it were. And the only way in which this is going to happen, or the fundamental way in which this is going to happen, is by classes entering into struggles with each other. History progresses, then, as the classes struggle against each other for preeminence, or fundamentally for survival. And really what we're aiming for in Marxism is something that has been called the dictatorship of the proletariat. Marx says that really, and here he's again more or less in line with certain kinds of bourgeois criticism, that really what we should be about is pursuing the greatest degree of happiness for the most number of people. The working class is the biggest class, and we should be trying to, as it were, find a way of maximising the happiness of everybody. But the best way to do that is not to take the interests of a very small group, the employers or the bourgeois class, and say that those interests should be normative. On the contrary, says Marx, we should start from the reality of material fact, where most of us in the working class share different kinds of interests. And it's the interest, therefore, of the working class that should predominate. And class struggle will lead us to a position where we can predominate. So the ruling class, profoundly aware of this situation, deals with this struggle at any moment by trying to persuade its proletarian opponents that everybody shares the same interests. And you will recognise this in literary criticism with phrases like, it is common sense that, or here is a common sense reading of the text. Or you will recognise it in talk about how certain authors are good because they reveal universal human truths, as if everybody shares exactly the same universe. In other words, there's no potential conflict. So this idea that we're all sharing the same interests is something that permeates literary criticism. And that idea, that attempt to regulate conflict, that idea whereby the ruling class will try to stop class struggle and therefore stop history, and they want to stop it because they're in quite a happy position, that regulation happens through something called ideology, as well as through certain kinds of social institution, which exist in order to, as it were, contain certain kinds of class struggle. Or indeed, institutions that exist to contain and restrain the possibility of any kind of struggle. Think of bourgeois marriage, for example, which pretends to not an equality between male and female, but pretends or aspires to a condition where everyone will accept particular kinds of role for the male and particular kinds of role for the female. It doesn't really matter what those roles are or whether they're equal. It simply means that in the institution we've found a way of containing, stopping the possibility of conflict, because those who enter that institution agree to its terms, fundamentally. Think of the institution of literary criticism in relation to this. And I'll come back to that in a moment. But let's talk a little bit about ideology first. Ideology is notoriously difficult to define. You might look up the work of Raymond Williams on this in a book called Keywords, and also in his book Marxism and Literature. And you can also look up the work of Terry Eagleton in a book called Ideology. Often, ideology is thought of as a system of beliefs and assumptions which are dominant and normative in a society at any given moment. The beliefs need not be true, they just need to operate as beliefs, and they need to operate as normative. Let me try to give you an example. A long time ago, when I was a wee boy, growing up in Glasgow, I travelled by public transport. And public transport in those times had bus drivers and bus conductors. The conductor took the fare and was actually in charge of the bus. The driver drove. The drivers were always male. The conductors were sometimes male, sometimes female. And it dawned on me at one point this was kind of peculiar. So when I was 5 years old or whatever, I said to my sister as I was standing at the bus stop one day, how come is it that the drivers are always male and the conductors are sometimes male, sometimes female? Why is it, I said, that women don't drive the buses? And she said in reply, because driving the buses is a man's job. And I said, oh. Now, oh is ideology. That response which says, I will not ask any more questions, I will take it for granted that this is just how things are, that this is, as it were, a quasi-natural state of affairs, is ideology. A couple of years later, I said, why is it that women don't drive buses? Why is it only a man's job? At this point, I'm starting to become a Marxist, because I'm starting to be critical of that ideology belief. And my sister says, because buses are big and heavy. And I said, but you don't push the thing. You drive the thing. And the pedals on the buses are no heavier to operate than the pedals in a car, which women drive routinely. And the wheel, okay, the driving wheel might be a wee bit bigger, but it's not so big that women can't. And anyway, most of the women I know are much stronger and bigger than I am, I said. At that point, we're moving out of ideology, because we are moving away from a system of taking things for granted as normative beliefs and moving into the possibility of critique. Here's another example that you've probably heard. Good literature is good because it contains universal values, essential human truths. It transcends its historical moment, that it speaks to all times, and so on. That's ideology for you. Let me offer you a kind of working definition of ideology for shorthand purposes here. Ideology might be defined as the way or ways in which a social formation represents itself to itself. Ideology is the way or ways in which a social formation represents itself to itself. You might think of that as the way in which a society thinks itself. The way in which a society gains and accepts norms and beliefs that constrain or define it. The purpose of Marxist criticism is to unmask ideology in order to reach something called knowledge, in order to reach something called thinking, in order to reach something called truth. How am I doing in terms of persuading you to become a Marxist? Have you accepted this so far, or are you finding this controversial? Controversial? Okay, I'm going to ask you why in a minute or two. Because the rest of you are on your way to joining me on the barricades, yeah? Yeah? Not quite. You don't want to go to the barricades, but you're... Okay. really what I'm asking you is, are you following the logic of the thing? Whether you accept it or not yet. Okay, good. Okay, let me move on to something which is slightly more technical now and slightly more difficult. This idea, production and materialism. And the German ideologists, another little bit of Marx, which I haven't given you in the handout. The beginning of the German ideology, Marx and Engels, this is an early work by them, and they're trying to work their way towards what eventually becomes known as Marxism. Here, they're thinking about what it is that distinguishes human people from everything else. And they write this. This is Marx's bit. Thinking a little bit about what he calls the first premises of materialist method. The first premise, he says, of all human history is, of course, the existence of living human individuals, axiomatically. You can't have a human history unless you're living human individuals. He also says the premises from which we begin are not arbitrary ones, not dogmas, but real premises from which abstraction can only be made in the imagination. They are the real individuals, their activity, and the material conditions under which they live, both those which they find already existing and those produced by their activity. That brings you back also to the beginning of the 18th Brumaire, that people are, as it were, given certain conditions in which to live, but also have the possibility of trying to transform them in various ways. And he writes this: men can be distinguished from animals by consciousness, by religion, or anything else you like. However, and this is axiomatic now for Marx, they themselves, men themselves, begin to distinguish themselves from animals as soon as they begin to produce their means of subsistence, a step which is conditioned by their physical organization. By producing their means of subsistence, men are indirectly producing their actual material life. So, this is the thing that distinguishes the human being from everything else. The fact that we produce ourselves. And we produce ourselves, first of all, by producing our means of subsistence, a way of keeping us going, a way of keeping us alive, and then, of course, through sex and through the labour associated with sex, literally reproducing ourselves, reproducing the next generation, which will, in turn, produce a transformation. Production and materiality is key here. Marx has no time. Well, he's a lot of time for the spiritual, but he sees the spiritual as being determined largely by the material. And he begins from material history, from, as it were, the uncontestable physical facts of the case. So not from ideas, but rather from material history. And texts, we Marxists would say, texts, like anything else, are produced in and by history. They are therefore determined. They are not, as it were, freely shaped by the idea of an author. Because that idea, the ideas that an author has, are themselves shaped by material history. The materiality of your body determines to some extent how you think. Quite simply, physically, even physiologically. And when your body is being tortured, for example, you will think things differently from the way in which you would feel if your body were not being tortured. And it need not be torture. It might just be tight clothing, which makes you feel uncomfortable, but which is fashionable. It might be, for example, in the 18th century, having to wear a girdle in order to make your body a particular shape, because the society accepts that that's the normative shape for women's bodies. But that affects the way in which you think. Sometimes it makes you faint. Read Jane Austen, and you'll see it happening chapter after chapter. A useful way to explore the implications of this idea of the primacy of materialism and of production would be through a consideration of the character or figure of the author, the literary author. Specifically, what I have in mind here is how Pierre Macheret thinks of the author. Pierre Macheret, the text to which I'm referring in this next bit, is a text called Towards a Theory of Literary Production. Towards a Theory of Literary Production, Pierre Macheret. Some criticisms proceed as if the author did not exist in a specific historical moment. This
is that kind of bourgeois criticism that isolates the text from politics, philosophy, art, history, society, and everything else. The effect of this is that the critic is forced to think about literature fundamentally in a rather idealist manner, in a very non-materialist manner. What does idealism mean here? Well, for present purposes, idealism can be thought of as a way of thinking that divorces the consciousness from history. It says there are two realms here. There's the realm in which you fall down, graze your knees, eat dinner, make love, and so on. That's material history. And there's another realm, the realm in which you think about these things, or imagine these things. Idealism, fundamental for present purposes, idealism is more complicated than this, but for present purposes, let's define idealism as something that, as it were, works with this split, believes that these two things are fundamentally separated from each other, and actually believes that it's possible to affect material reality quite simply by thinking it differently. A kind of fantasy world, as it were. So the idealist is someone who works fundamentally with the split between consciousness on the one hand and history on the other. Shakespeare, therefore, for the idealist, would be seen as relevant to the 20th century's concerns and problems because his texts speak to all historical moments and so on. In other words, his texts have nothing to do with material history. They are all in the realm, and the way we think of them is in the realm of this consciousness thing that's divorced from history. And back in 1595, we had people who were thinking and imagining the world and imagining falling in love and so on. And today, we have people who are thinking about falling in love and so on. Therefore, Shakespeare is relevant to today. The fact that we constructed the family very differently in 1595 from the way in which we construct it now as a historical material fact is ignored by the critic who says that Shakespeare transcends his historical moment in this kind of way. As for Shakespeare, so for anybody. When people say to you that authors transcend their specific historical moment, all they're saying is, I'm not a very good historian. I don't know very much about history. And therefore, I'll be content if you don't batter me with historical facts either, please. The counter to this is a more materialist historical position adopted by Marxism. The author, like everything else, is an effect or product of her or his historical moment. Authors are produced in historical moments. But more than that, Macheret argues that like any worker, the author is actually essentially a producer. That's what authors do, they produce things. She or he will take certain raw materials, could be language, could be the previous history of writing, could be a batch of other plays that I happen to have been reading, and having taken those raw materials, the author works the materials and transforms them through her or his labour in the production of the new text. And if you think about it, that's how you write anything. It's how you write poetry. When you want to write a love poem, one of the things you will do is look at earlier love poems. And you will get something from that. They will shape your consciousness to some extent. And even if you don't directly allude to them in the poem that you write, nonetheless, your consciousness has been shaped and informed in some ways, informed by them. And what you produce is therefore not just, as it were, you, but it's you and all these other authors crowding in on you. So the production is rather like taking certain raw materials, the cotton I was talking about earlier, and transforming it into something of greater value. As in any production, there is surplus value, an excess of something. So, first point here, the author, for Macheret, does not create out of nothing, does not create out of her or his own free-floating ideas, ideas that are somehow divorced from history. She produces a text through labour and transformation. The excess thus produced can be easily thought of as an excess of signification. The text says more than the author meant to say, because it's got all these other voices. Remember Marx talking about the voices of the dead at the beginning of the 18th premiere. It's got all these other voices coming through. Secondly, there is now a tension between the ostensible meaning of the author on the one hand and the linguistic capacity of the text on the other. Let's do this with a little diagram on the board, if I can. Okay. Here's
Here's your text. Bourgeois criticism says that that text contains ideas, the ideas of the author. Macheret says, in order to make that text, you've had to take some raw materials, call it language, call it other poems, whatever, and you've transformed them. And in doing so, you've produced an excess. You've produced something bigger than you thought you had produced.
Exactly, when I take a batch of cotton and make a coat from it, on the one hand, it's just cotton. But on the other hand, it has been transformed. I've not, as if I've added any more cotton in order to make it a coat. I've not added gold to make it a coat. I've just used the raw materials. But it's now different from the batch of cotton that I was given.
Think of this bigger circle then, if you like, as a coat. Think of this as the cotton that makes the coat. The bourgeois critic believes that the author is to be found in the cotton, and the totality of the text is to be found in the cotton. Macheret says, no. The totality of the text is to be found in the discrepancy between the cotton and the coat. Between, if you like, what the text ostensibly means, what the author meant when he wrote Love's Labour's Lost, and what the text means as a transformation of the language and ideas that shaped the possibility of Shakespeare when he made that particular play. So we now have a text that, as Macheret would say, is decentered, fissured, broken, fragmented. The text that is produced is always incomplete in some kind of way. And our task as literary critics is to attend to the fact that the text is fissured, broken. Since the text is produced from within a certain specific ideology, there are certain things that it cannot directly say, because there are certain things that it cannot think. However, the excess here sometimes reveals what the text itself can say. The quote, if you like, reveals the potential of the cotton that the cotton itself cannot articulate. If you let me stick with that metaphor. The task of the critic, says Macheret,
is not to look at the words on the page, not at the cotton, but rather, having looked at the discrepancy between the cotton and the coat, to find what it is impossible for the text to say, to find what the author could not have said because of the ideology that shaped the author. At that moment, you're finding what the text means, how it performs in a particular society. You're finding the beliefs that shape and govern that society, and you're finding, therefore, how it is that the author either conforms to those beliefs or distances herself from those beliefs, and more importantly still, you're finding out something fundamental about the construction, or better, production of meaning. Because you as a reader are now also engaged in an act of production. You're producing literary meaning. So while the American New Critics would tell you to focus on the words on the page, Macheret gets you to focus, if you like, on the words off the page, that which the text cannot possibly say. It's that that becomes important. Texts used to be thought of as being centred upon their author's consciousness. After Macheret, texts are decentred, disunified, incomplete. There is therefore no central essence to the text, just endless contradiction and incoherence. There's always a contradiction between, if you like, the coat and the cotton, to go back to that diagram. And that incoherence can only be masked if we make the false assumption that a text can be isolated from its historical moment, or if we become idealists, and if we pretend that a coat is nothing more than the cotton. Let me move on again to this idea of Marxism being against interpretation. And let me begin here by stopping now being a vulgar Marxist. And I said, you know, in the position of the vulgar Marxist, I said that the base determines the superstructure. That capital, as it were, capitalism as an economic structure, determines the shape of everything else, how we think about everything else. The vulgar Marxist believes that.
given that I'm not very vulgar, but I'm actually quite tasteful, let me stop being a vulgar Marxist for a moment, and let me propose to you what, as it were, a more developed Marxism argues, which is actually in line with the Marx of the 18th Remain. Certainly, capitalism determines to a large extent what happens in the superstructure, but it does not totally determine it. There is what Marx would call a dialectical relation between base and superstructure. And it follows from this that changes in the superstructure can affect the base. So changes, for example, in the way in which we think about the bourgeois contract of love that we identify as marriage, can change things in the fundamental economic base. And we know that because the contract that we enter into now in bourgeois forms of marriage or civil partnerships are fundamentally based upon a slightly more equal relation between the two partners than used to be the case heretofore. And that means, for example, that we no longer think of the male-female sexual or erotic relation being based simply and straightforwardly on exploitation in the way in which we used to do. It still is based upon exploitation, don't get me wrong, but, I'm still opposed to it, but it's not exactly as it used to be. In other words, certain ways in which we've changed the institution of marriage, for example, in this example, affect how we think the economic relation govern society. So there's a kind of dialectical relation. It would follow from that that what we do with texts may have an impact beyond the purely literary. Up until now, we've thought that what we do with texts is to interpret them. And bourgeois criticism argues that we can say whatever we like about a text, so long as we can provide the evidence for our opinion from the text itself. Marxism doesn't have too much time for opinions. Opinions are quite common. Everybody's got one. And they don't matter, because an opinion is something you never need to prove. Marxism prefers science. Scientia against opinio, as it used to be called in the Renaissance. But the belief, the bourgeois belief, that we can say whatever the hell we like about a text, so long as we provide evidence for what we say from the text itself, that assumes a certain freedom and subjectivity in the reader. And that is the position challenged by Louis Althusser, who I'm going to speak about now. Individuals are themselves determined by history and culture. I speak English, for example, I dress in a particular way, I give lectures like this and so on, only because I live in early 21st century European culture. I wouldn't do this if I lived, for example, in the Amazonian rainforest. It would be a wee bit peculiar, and all my tribespeople around about me would think, Thomas has gone a bit funny. Look at the trousers, like the waistcoat, but look at the trousers. Why is he doing that? Why is he blethering away about this guy called Althusser? We've never heard of, and actually we've got no interest in. In other words, the historical conjuncture in which we as individuals find ourselves determines what we can do and say. I also think the way I do, partly because of the culture that has formed me. And yet, I'm sure you don't feel yourself to be completely determined by your culture. I'm sure you feel yourself to be free. It's a wee bit like how we used to characterise the difference between, back in the days of the Cold War, between the United States and the Soviet Union, back in those days, there used to be a very clear difference between the Soviet Union, which was communist, and the West, or America. In the Soviet Union, people were not free, and they knew it. In America, people were not free, but they believed they were. That's still the statement. That's the difference that Althusser focuses on. You believe you're free, you couldn't live the way in which you do unless you believed you were free, autonomous, and so on. But you're not. There's nothing wrong with being determined in some ways. It just means we have to deal with it in certain kinds of ways. It's an unhappy feeling to feel that you're not free, especially that your thinking is not free. It's an unhappy position to be in. But people feel themselves to be different from this. We feel ourselves to be free, autonomous, and capable of producing ourselves in whatever way we choose. And for Althusser, it is ideology, or the ideological state apparatuses, as he calls them, that enables that belief. If you turn now to your handout, I'll take you through some parts of this handout. I noticed this morning when I picked it up from the office that it's chopped off a little bit at the left-hand side. So let's start at the bit you have to read A from the side, you know, kind of portrait side. As Marx said, every child knows that a social formation which did not reproduce the conditions of production at the same time as it produced would not last a year. In other words, a social formation has to keep producing itself as well as producing its modes of production. The ultimate condition of production is therefore the reproduction of the conditions of production. This may be simple, as he called it, reproducing exactly the previous conditions of production, or on an extended scale, expanding. So how does it do this? How does a society reproduce itself? Well, it does it through what he calls the ideological state apparatuses. And what are the ideological state apparatuses? They mustn't be confused, says Althusser, with what he calls the repressive state apparatus. Remember that in Marx's theory, the state apparatus contains the government, the administration, the army, the police, the court, the prisons, etc., which constitute what I shall in future call the repressive state apparatus. Repressive suggests that the state apparatus in question functions by violence, at least ultimately. And we know that because ultimately the army, the police, will force you down the stage, as it were. They will force you to do certain things, if need be. I shall call ideological state apparatuses a certain number of realities which present themselves to the immediate observer in the form of distinct and specialised institutions. I propose an empirical list of these, which will obviously have to be examined, detailed, tested, corrected, reorganised. With all the reservations implied by this requirement, we can for the moment regard the following institutions as ideological state apparatuses. The order in which I list them has no particular significance. There's the religious ISA, the system of different churches. The educational ISA, the system of different public and private schools. The family ISA, the legal ISA, the political ISA, the trade union ISA, communications ISA, the cultural ISA. So there are all these institutions, church, educational systems, family, the law, and so on. And these, says Althusser, are part of the state apparatus. They're part of the apparatus of the state, and they function ideologically. You turn to the right-hand side of the page here. The repressive state apparatus, he writes here, functions massively and predominantly by repression, while functioning secondarily by ideology. There's no such thing as a pure repressive apparatus. For example, the army and the police also function by ideology, both to ensure their own cohesion and reproduction, and in the values they propound externally. Values that you would recognise as the values of discipline, order, hierarchy, and so on. A police officer once explained to me that I had to understand that the police were a quasi-military organisation, and they operated exactly like the military, with a very strong sense of non-criticism of superiors. You do not criticise your superiors, you stay quiet. If you know your place, in other words, you are disciplined in doing that, and you are organised according to a very strict hierarchy, and you do what you are told, you obey orders. That's the ideology, and it affects you, even though you're not police officers. In the same way, but inversely, says Althusser, it's essential to say that for their part, the ISAs function massively and predominantly by ideology. They also function secondarily by repression. Even if ultimately, but only ultimately, this is very attenuated to conceal it and symbolic. Thus, schools and churches use suitable methods of punishment, expulsion, selection, etc., to discipline not only their shepherds but also their flocks. You know this. It's called examinations, or it's called applying to get into Warwick University, or it's called trying to, as it were, find a way through all this without being disciplined by, for example, somebody who in the hierarchy is higher than you, me, in this particular case. And you know what you have to say to get through examinations. This is ideology working. It's an ideological state apparatus which is there not, says Althusser, not to make you a good literary critic, but to make you a good citizen, to make you somebody which the present condition of our society requires you to be. It requires, as it were, you to conform in certain kinds of ways. He says also, and you can read this on yourself, the church used to be the biggest of the ISAs, but it's been replaced in our time by the school, by which he means the university and the educational apparatus. The educational apparatus exists, according to Althusser, primarily to allow a capitalist society to reproduce itself. and to reproduce itself with people who believe in it freely. But he's at pains to point out that given this is purely ideological, you're not free. On the back side of the handout, he explains how it is that there's an ambiguity when you think of yourself as a free subject. To be a subject means to be in control of a statement, as in being the subject of a sentence. The I that kicks the dog, for example. I kick the dog. In that sentence, I am the subject of the verb. But to be a subject, especially here, in this particular island, is also to be subjected. And to be subjected means to be subjected to things, to be forced to do certain things, as we are increasingly finding ourselves in the position of just now. Marxism, as a literary criticism, is bigger than just talking about literature. It is about changing the fundamental ways in which a society organises itself. Marx writes a number of theses on another philosopher called Feuerbach, F-E-U-E-R-B-A-C-H. The 11th thesis on Feuerbach goes like this. Up until now, the philosophers have only interpreted the world. The point, however, is to change it. And that's why Marxism, for those of us who are Marxist literary critics, is so important. It's not just a matter of, as it were, interpreting things. Interpretations are not important in this. It's a matter of changing things. It's a matter of changing the fundamental relations of exploitation that keep people, you, me, oppressed. If you want to carry on being oppressed, keep your hand down when I say which of you are Marxists. If you want to, as it were, staff the barricades, you can now join the Marxist, I won't call it a revolution just yet, but a Marxist movement. I'll stop on that for today. I won't ask you now how many, in case I fail, I have to convince you. But next week, feminism is what we're going to do. And I'll probably do the same thing. Thank you for today. Thanks for your attention today. Good luck.